This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about losing your voice. We just heard from NPR science reporter Richard Harris, who you may have heard recently. He lost his voice due to unilateral vocal fold paralysis. He's on his way back. It's something that I struggled with some years ago, and we're taking some of your calls at 860-275-7266 in just a bit. If you've had problems losing your voice for whatever reason, we'd love to hear your story, and we're going to talk a bit about some of the treatments and some of the reasons behind this with Dr. Dennis Lafreniere, who is the Director of the Voice and Speech Clinic at the University of Connecticut Health Center. Doctor, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, first of all, just in reaction to a bit of what you heard from Richard Harris, what is your reaction to his particular case? He had some hope here of getting his voice back from what you can hear?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very typical situation. And he was right in saying that most often this is caused by a surgical procedure. He mentioned surgery in the chest, but thyroid surgery or surgery on the anterior portion of the spine can lead to this as well. The nerve can get stretched and it can stop working. Now, oftentimes that nerve can come back, but it's a very long nerve. And it takes a while for that to heal, and that process of healing can typically take up to a year to occur. So getting your vocal cord to a position where it's useful for you is one of the things that we can do either through therapeutic interventions with a speech therapist or, like Richard had, an injection in the vocal cord to move it over so that the other good vocal cord can touch it.
And just so that we're clear, I didn't ask him about this. I meant to, but the injection is of cellulose. It's essentially just a material to just push the vocal cord closer to the other one, correct?
Right. There are several different materials that are used out there. One is a dermis preparation. Another one is almost bone particle-like. Fat has also been used to move the vocal fold over. All of these are temporary measures to move the vocal cord over. In cases where it doesn't work or that doesn't last long enough, we can actually go in with a procedure under local anesthesia where we'll take a little piece of either Gore-Tex tape or plastic and permanently move the vocal cord over. And those are in cases where we know they won't recover again.
And we'll be talking about some other problems that maybe need different types of interventions in just a little bit. But first of all, why don't you explain how exactly the vocal cords work? It's a fascinating thing, nerves and cords and all this stuff that seemingly works completely involuntarily to us. We think of a word, we say the word, it comes out, and we don't think about how this stuff works. So how does it work?
Sure, you hit on a very good point. The larynx and the voice are one of those things that we can control, but we never think about controlling it. When the phone rings, you pick it up and say hello. You don't think about how you're doing that. But yet we can control the pitch, we can control the volume, and that's where speech therapy comes in. But physiologically what happens is the vocal cords, we call them vocal folds now, but everyone understands them as vocal cords, are actually strips of muscle. And they're connected in the front as sort of a letter V. They sit horizontally right in our Adam's apple. Now, that strip of muscle is covered by a loose skin, and the skin is loose like the sleeve on your arm. So when you actually bring the vocal folds together, the air coming up between them grabs the lining of that vocal fold, and it causes it to ripple very quickly. In a male, about 150 times a second. In a female, typically 250 times a second. And that creates a buzz in the airstream that our mouth and our throat then select certain frequencies from, and it becomes your voice. And that's the way it works. So when Richard had his vocal cord that wasn't moving, the other vocal cord was coming to the middle, but it wasn't touching anything. So all the air was escaping, and that's why his voice was so very breathy. So what the injection did is it just moved that paralyzed vocal cord to the middle so the good vocal cord can touch it, creating a good competent valve, and the air coming up through created the wave in the vocal folds, and then we can hear the voice.
So that's the mechanics behind it. Does everyone's mechanics work more or less the same way?
They do, but modifications in technique can change that. Sometimes you'll hear, as we hear some high school young women will speak with some significant glottal fry. He mentioned that glottal fry, which is more of a percolating of sound through the vocal cords. It sounds very gravelly, where your voice might sound kind of like that.
It's the Bill Clinton sound, and I'll
correct,
come back to that.
Correct.
That's sort of what I sounded like for a while. It's that sound of it's almost all fry and very little tone coming out in a lot of cases. Yeah,
correct. There's two parts to any voice issue. There's what we call the tissue issues,
yeah.
Where if the vocal cords aren't moving or if they're swollen from a virus or from allergy or from irritation from reflux, we have to treat the medical issue. issue to get it better. Then there's the muscle use issues, how you're bringing the vocal cords together or vocal folds together, how you're using breath support to support the voice. These are things that the speech pathologist will work with to make sure you're using the system efficiently. It's easy to fall into bad vocal use habits.
I want to give out our phone number again, 860-275-7266. Let's quickly get to Peter in Danbury. Hi there, Peter. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Yes. My name is Peter, and several years ago, I had a viral meningitis. I was hospitalized, and by the time I left the hospital about 3 days later, I was unable to vocalize at all. That is to say, I could only whisper, and that condition remained for about 11 and a half months. And finally, for Christmas, I got something of a voice back, and now I have what you hear today.
Mm.
So very threatening to my livelihood because I'm a physician. I'm a primary doctor, and I did a lot of phone work. People could not hear me. I could not work with the staff at the hospital because they could not hear me. It's always noisy around the nursing station. And
yeah.
So I had to change the way I practiced. And I saw a lot of doctors and got a lot of different opinions and tried the physical therapy piece. But my insurance was very sneaky. They allowed 30 visits, but you had to do them in 1 month.
Oh.
I had to give that up. It was a very traumatic event, and couldn't go out to restaurants because I thought what I had to say might be important or at least social.
Well, what I want to do, and Peter, thank you so much for sharing that story because I think it's so important. When we started this program, we knew we were going to talk to Richard Harris, and we also talked about how a lot of professional singers have been having problems recently, high profile in the news. And many people come to me and say, boy, if you lost your voice and you're on the radio, that must be terrible. But, you know, having a microphone in front of your face is a wonderful thing. I can whisper and people can hear me. Most people can't. The doctor who just called us can't. A teacher who has to project to the back row of a classroom can't. And these are the people you see, doctor. There's not a lot of people on the radio. There's a lot of people in his line of work who need this help.
Absolutely. I mean, anyone who uses their voice all day, in our opinion, is a professional voice user. And everything's important. An operatic soprano who can't hit one note can't work. But a teacher who can't talk to Johnny in the last row of the classroom also can't work. And so our job is to get you back to doing what you're doing. And that's what we do with a sort of a comprehensive approach at our Voice and Speech Center. This particular case, the encephalitis, was probably a central cause of his vocal cords not working. Most of the time, as we're talking about, it's usually a peripheral cause where one nerve in one side isn't working. He may have actually had trouble with both sides, depending on what the situation was there. But it can be a tremendously emotional and impactful event to not have your voice there with you. Most folks who have voice issues, especially, they have more difficulty on the phone because there are no visual cues for communication, so they have a tremendous problem with that as well. And so it's important to get them treated.
And the more you talk in that labored way, it tires you out. It wears you out. And it begins to hurt your voice. Richard Harris says it's not painful, even though it's painful sounding sometimes. But if you're using your voice in the wrong way for an extended period of time, it becomes very painful, debilitatingly so.
Absolutely. And that's where you can start to strain to the point where you start causing additional damage to your larynx. And that's where working with a speech pathologist, making sure you're using things as efficiently as possible is so very important. You run out of breath. Richard was probably taking two or three breaths just to complete one sentence because he did not have a competent valve and air was just leaking out. So getting that closed and getting it to so that he didn't have to strain so much. Any kind of Valsalva maneuver, anything where you're lifting up something heavy, you have to close off the vocal cords to keep that air in. People have trouble doing things like that, lifting up. They'll get very fatigued and very tired.
Mm. I want to get to another phone call here quickly. Kate is in Cheshire. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, hi. I was calling. I live with something called a laryngospasm, which is secondary to maybe reflux, but also I may have some damage to the cranial nerves. And one of the issues, I also am, I'm a social worker and I use my voice, and I'm having some difficulty returning to work because, you know, the pacing of how I use my voice is a challenge, which is kind of one question I have. And the second question is also about, a lot of times the laryngospasm or this kind of the tiredness that comes in with the voice is sometimes interpreted as anxiety or something, and I know anxiety can sometimes make it worse, but it really is a physiological issue. So my questions are those two things about pacing, and then how, when you use your voice and it's kind of misinterpreted as something more emotional.
Well, Kate, thank you very much for sharing. The doctor, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Laryngospasm can occur. Oftentimes it happens when people are trying to breathe. They'll have a situation where the vocal cords will close when they're breathing in, and it can create a stridorous kind of a kind of a sound. And that can occur. There can be a neurologic cause for that. There can sometimes be a breathing inefficiency that helps cause that as well. And therapy can help that. And occasionally we'll actually do a weakening of the muscles with Botox injections for people who are having significant problems with those types of spasms. But the perception of the voice by people, that's actually very appropriate. People are always saying, are you sick? Are you okay? And that can take a toll on the patient. That type of a question, sometimes speech therapy can really be helpful in helping to get more of a sustained, steady voice when a patient does have a problem like that.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to get to her call, so I'll get into a little bit of what I had to go through. From what I was told, a reaction to mold that was in the facility I was working in at the time caused me to have some very bad throat problems, which then never resolved themselves. But over time, what I was told by people I worked with, and I've heard this and read this, is that there is a psychological component to this. There is a certain amount where over time you learn how, you forget how to actually be able to do the things that you're easily able to do normally because of some sort of earlier physical trauma. I don't know if you can talk through that, because anxiety is actually a part of this for some people.
Absolutely. I tell all my patients this, any voice problem from whatever cause is made worse by anxiety and stress. And that's just a given. But let's use an example of a teacher, and this happens often. A teacher will come in having had a laryngitis. They might miss a day of school or not. They end up going to school, and Johnny in the last row has to hear them. So they start to push their voice so Johnny hears them. And they'll come in and see me 6 months later saying, Doc, it's the worst cold I ever had. And they're talking in the same strained fashion. Well, the cold has long gone away. The vocal folds are probably completely normal, but they habitualized that voice use pattern, and that becomes the way they normally speak. So we have to get you to realize, have to get you as a patient to realize that you can change what you're doing with your voice and get back into a more relaxed, normal voice use pattern. So you can habituate some bad patterns. When you had a bad mold exposure, an allergy exposure, you got some swelling, you were trying to generate your voice in what you thought was normal and probably got into an abnormal voice use pattern. And then working with speech therapy, typically you're able to get it back out.
And the thing that we hear from some singers, people who use their voice in a very extreme fashion, is they do damage to their vocal cords, maybe even like the teacher that you just experienced or you gave us an experience of. Tell us about nodules, polyps, things that happen when you actually are doing damage to your vocal cords.
Correct. You can, when you have a vocal misuse, you can start to get swelling of the vocal fold. It's very similar to when you're raking the yard without a glove and you start to get a little blister on your hand. The same thing can happen to the vocal folds. And that most of the time we catch it early, 90% of nodules will go away by modifying what you're doing with the larynx. If it's been going on for a long period of time, sometimes they'll be fibrotic. Sometimes you'll get things like polyps or there'll be cysts, things like that can happen. But cysts are more of a congenital issue. We may have to do surgery to get that removed. That's the extreme case. Oftentimes therapy will work, but occasionally we do need to do surgery on the vocal folds to get things better.
I want to get to a call here from David in Glastonbury. Hi there, David.
Hi. Can you hear me? I'm on speakerphone.
I sure can. What's on your mind?
Okay. I just wanted to thank you for having this program, because I've had this kind of trouble for three or four years now. It started with hoarseness. Had it diagnosed as a partial paralysis of a vocal cord. of a nuisance. As you can tell, I have limited ability to speak a prolonged sentence, and I do read on Chris Radio, and I sing in the choir, and it's causing me a bit of a nuisance. You have made me determined now to get some speech therapy about this. Following you along, it gets increased in times of tension.
What I might do is let me leave you on the line here so you can hear about what the doctor has to say. And thank you, David, so much for calling. And I hope that you're able to get some help, because this is the sort of thing that can persist for a very long time. When people say, okay, now I want to go to a speech therapist, what happens? What is the next thing that happens to them? And how are you able to help folks, doctor?
Sure. Well, typically we like to have a full evaluation. And so people will typically come in to see me. We'll evaluate the larynx, and we use special technology, special type of scope that's called a video stroboscopy. It allows us to look at the wave motion of the vocal cords in vocal folds in very slow motion. In this, we can then make the diagnosis of what's going on. If there's a functional component, then my voice-trained speech therapist will then take the patient and do an assessment and then follow that up with therapy. In this particular case, there's a partial paralysis or paresis, we can actually do a test. It's called an EMG, where we take a very fine acupuncture needle, and we actually stick it right through the skin of the front of the neck. It's not a horribly painful procedure.
Doesn't sound fun.
It's not the most, but it's very, very tolerable. Yeah. But we can actually measure the electrical activity going to the muscles and see if one side is weaker than the other. If that's the case, sometimes there's some voice therapy techniques that can actually help to get the other vocal fold to cross the midline and touch that weaker vocal fold to increase the voice. The other issue is, as we get older, sometimes our vocal folds will start to bow a little bit, and that's why older folks will have a bit more of a breathy quality of their voice when they're speaking, because air is leaking out. And speech therapy can also help that. If we drive more air through the system, it will actually draw the vocal folds together, and they'll get better. And in extreme cases, we can also inject material very similar to what Richard Harris had injected into the middle of the vocal folds to plump them up to kind of close that gap.
And for people who maybe just want to find out a little bit more about how to maybe train a voice that is going to work for them better, that is going to maybe take some strain off the vocal cords, Richard Harris mentioned some techniques. Would you suggest that people see a speech therapist? Are there other resources available online? Where would you send people to get some of these techniques?
There are lots of material available online, and just looking into voice therapy techniques is very helpful. If someone feels that they're really having difficulty with their voice and it's an issue, they should get evaluated, and speech therapists can really help them there. But if there's any tissue problems going on, a physician really does need to take a look just to make sure that everything is safe. And then work with the speech pathologist after that.
We're talking with Dr. Dennis Lafreniere, who is the director of the Voice Speech Clinic at the University of Connecticut Health Center. We're talking about losing one's voice. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be taking more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. We'll also be talking to a woman who got the second ever voice box transplant. If you want to join the conversation, you can also email us wherewelive at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll wrap up this week's Supreme Court case on the Affordable Care Act. Also, we'll talk with Representative Andy Fleischman about the revisions to Governor Malloy's education bill. And we'll preview a talk at the Connecticut Historical Society in Real Artways on the history of the KKK in New England in the 1900s. There's a lot to talk about tomorrow, Where We Live. Hope you can join us on air and online at WNPR.org, keyword where. Today, our guest is Dr. Dennis Lafreniere, who is director of the Voice and Speech Clinic at the University of Connecticut Health Center. We talked earlier in the program with Richard Harris from NPR, who's been losing his voice and trying to get it back. We're talking with people who have lost their voice or have some experience, as I do with this. You can join us 860-275-7266. Quickly, let's get to Mary Kay in Stanford. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind? You're on the air.
Okay. Well, about 12 years ago, I had neck surgery. It was a triple discectomy, I guess, with fusion. And during this procedure, they had to move my vocal cords aside. And one of them, as it turned out, ended up becoming paralyzed. But I didn't know that. I had a very squeaky voice for the year following the surgery. And the doctor told me that it would recover eventually. But then actually I went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor about 5 years ago and was told that it was 100% paralyzed, but that my other vocal cord compensated for it, so I have a normal voice now.
Oh, it compensated for it.
It ended up compensating, so I guess in the long run I'm lucky, but I guess what I would like to say online is that I think it's important for people after they have surgery, especially neck surgery, if they have any issue with their voice, that they should go immediately, I think, for therapy and find out what's going on.
I don't think the Dr. Lafreniere is going to disagree with you there. Thank you for your story, Mary Kay. Doctor, yeah.
No, you sound great, Mary Kay. But she's done very well. That's one of the very common procedures where they actually have to move the larynx out of the way and it can stretch the nerve. And compensation is exactly what we send you to speech therapy for. You get the good vocal fold to cross the midline, find the paralyzed one, and voices can sound almost 100% normal. And having never heard her before, I would say she had a normal-sounding voice to me.
Well, Mary Kay, thank you very much for your story, and I'm glad that you're sounding better. That, as you say, is the type of procedure that happens often. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk with someone next who's had a procedure that does not happen often. Brenda Charette-Jensen is the recipient of the second-ever voice box transplant. Brenda joins us by phone. Thank you so much for being here on Where We Live.
Thank you.
From what I understand, Brenda, you couldn't speak at all except through an electronic device before this surgery. Maybe you can tell me a bit about why you had to have the surgery in the first place.
Okay. About 13 years ago, my kidneys failed, and they ventilated me. And when they were waking me up from the sedation, I pulled out the ventilation tube from my neck, and it paralyzed my vocal cords.
Oh. And so it paralyzed your vocal cords, and the determination was made eventually that the only way that you were going to get a voice back was through a transplant?
Yes, I was qualified for the transplant because I was already on immune-suppressant drugs because I ended up getting a kidney pancreas transplant in 2006.
Dr. Lafreniere, is this a surgery that you know very much about? This sounds extreme.
Well, there aren't too many out there. The examples have typically been post-traumatic. People who might need them typically have had cancer and they wouldn't be candidates. But the real trick is getting the nerves hooked up correctly and getting it to function. And that's the real challenge. There aren't a whole lot of places that are doing them currently.
You know, Brenda, we've seen in the news in the last few years a few cases, a very high-profile cases of people getting face transplants, and there's been huge questions about who that person is after a transplant like that. Do they retain the same identity when they have someone else's face? And I guess I wonder for you, do you feel as though you have someone else's voice?
Well, I'm still going to therapy because my voice does change all the time. The voice therapy that I'm going to, they tell me that the nerves haven't totally set yet, so my voice will change periodically. And this morning I'm a little bit gurgly.
Well, and doctor, is there anything to that? I mean, if someone is transplanted with somebody else's vocal cords, I mean, essentially, are you getting someone else's voice, or doesn't it work that way?
Well, it could to a slight degree change, but a lot of what makes our voice is the resonance chambers, which is our mouth, our nose. Those are what select out the frequencies that help give you your particular quality voice. So, yeah, there'd be some change because the voice source, the vocal folds, are going to be different. They're going to be a slightly different size and thickness, but there's still the personality of our voice should still be there. Some of the inflections.
But Brenda, as you go through this therapy and you try to get your voice back, are you seeing progress? Are you feeling as though you're sounding better all the time?
Oh, yes. My friends that I went to school with, they tell me that they hear Brenda coming out all the time. And I actually have the voice box, spinal gland, and vocal cord transplant, and it was the second one in the world.
It's an amazing procedure, and I thank you so much for sharing your story and for talking with us a bit today on the program. Thank you, Brenda. That's Brenda Charette-Jensen, the recipient of the second ever voice box transplant here on the program. We hopefully get to another phone call here or two. Andrea is calling from Wallingford. Andrea, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am actually a speech pathologist, and I work with a patient right now who went in for a cardiac surgery and came out. She was intubated during the surgery, and when they extubated her, they paralyzed her right vocal cord. And I've been working with her for quite some time right now. I have another little twist to this story. She's on a feeding tube and cannot safely eat anything by mouth because her vocal cord is not protecting her airway when she swallows. So I've been doing some pretty aggressive voice therapy with her, and she's made some significant progress in the quality of her voice. We recently did another swallow study on her, and she still cannot eat anything safely by mouth because she aspirates everything into her lungs. And I guess my question is, she's a very interesting patient of mine. My question is, what's next? What else can I do for her to help try to move that vocal cord? Because she's a young person, and she was a nurse manager. And
well, let me get a quick answer, if you don't mind, from the doctor, because we're running low on time. Go ahead, doctor.
Sure. She needs to see an ENT. I would recommend getting an EMG, where you see where the status of that nerve is, and then she could have a temporary injection to move that vocal fold over. That should help her. It should help her swallowing and help her voice, and that's something that can be done relatively easily. Oftentimes can be done right in the office if the patient is amenable to that. And so that's what I would recommend.
Andrea, thanks for your phone call, and best of luck. Sue is in Manchester. Sue, you want to touch on something that I really wanted to get to here on the program. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Spasmodic dysphonia. My son's had it for several years. He's had all the tests. He's been at Mass Eye and Ear. And he's had all the workups, all the tests, blood work, the whole nine yards. And he's done the last results, which he's tried not to have done, but he's done it, Botox. It only lasts a few months, and then he's back to no voice. And he's a lawyer, and you can understand why that's a problem.
And Sue, thank you so much for bringing this up. For people who don't know the term, the spasmodic dysphonia, this is what Diane Rehm, the NPR personality from WAMU, she's dealt with for years and years and years. Very distinctive, if you know what that sounds like. Tell us about this condition, doctor.
Sure. It's actually a neurologic condition. So, vocal cord muscle tension dysphonia is something that we can teach you to not do with speech therapy. Spasmodic dysphonia is an abnormal signal from the brain telling the larynx to contract when it shouldn't. And the treatment of choice currently is Botox. We inject into the vocal folds themselves. Oftentimes we'll alternate one side from the other. And it just breaks up the reflex loop. The signal going from the larynx to the brain gets changed, and then the brain doesn't tell the larynx to over-squeeze anymore. It is currently the treatment of choice for this in the United States. There are some operative procedures to try and permanently fix this. They're not done throughout the United States, and there's some success with those as well. But Botox currently is the treatment. And oftentimes, if you do Botox and then some speech therapy, you can increase the length of the effect of Botox. But Botox is usually gone by within 4 months of the time you inject it.
So it is something that you have to come back for more injections.
Correct.
Over time. Does it get, with the Botox injections and maybe speech therapy, does it get better? Or is this just maintaining a situation here?
Spasmodic dysphonia typically is not cured. But there can be periods where it gets quiescent, where people can go a year, year and a half without needing to have an injection. And in certain types of spasmodic dysphonia, the voice can get back to near normal, 95 to 100% normal in the most common type of spasmodic dysphonia.
Sue, thank you very much for bringing that up. Donna, you're in Stanford. Go quickly, if you would. You're on Where We Live.
Sure. Hi there. I was diagnosed with having one working vocal cord. I think it's also paralyzed. And then I heard that I have Lyme disease. And I'm wondering if you know if that could be a cause. And I'm in the process of just looking for a doctor now. And I was wondering if you recommend that I see a specialist, or can any regular ENT help me? Because the one ENT I saw really wasn't very helpful.
Well, Donna, thank you so much. Doctor, yeah.
Sure, yes. Lyme's disease could be a cause for vocal cord paralysis.
And why is that?
Lyme's disease can actually cause many neurologic situations. So it's one of our standard panels to test for Lyme's whenever we have a patient who has vocal fold paralysis. Most ENTs will be able to diagnose you. Some aren't necessarily going to do vocal cord injections in the office. Those who specialize in laryngology will do that for you. But you should be able to find that care here in Connecticut.
Donna, I wish you the best of luck. Doctor, in just the last couple of seconds we have, this idea of giving someone their voice back, you know, we've all seen the King's Speech, the acclaimed movie about speech therapy. There's something powerful about this, because when you lose your voice, you lose an awful lot of your ability to be a human. And this must be rewarding for you to find people who don't have a voice and give it back to them.
Well, it can be very satisfying. I'll just leave you one story. I had a gentleman who was actually dying of cancer, and the cancer had taken out his vocal cord. He couldn't speak. His son was getting married in California, and we were able to move his vocal fold over so he had a voice. He was able to get out to California, spend the time with his son, had a wonderful time at the wedding. He's since passed, but we were able to give him that, and it's a wonderful thing. The voice is all part of us. It's our personality, and it's wonderful to be able to give that back sometimes.
I really appreciate you spending some time with us. Dr. Dennis LaFreniere is director of the Voice and Speech Clinic at the University of Connecticut Health Center. We'll put links on our website as well, WNPR.org, keyword WEAR. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Tucker Ives produces our program. Katie Talarski is the senior producer. Thanks to our interns, Sam Neary, Heather Brandon, Yasmin Elgohari. Thanks also to Betsy Kaplan and Amy Talit. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.